Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in Central Europe, though it is other days and other times at other places because we live in a round earth and we have time zones all over the place. And with me here tonight, right now, I have Leonardo Heredia, and he's calling us all the way in sunny Argentina. Leonardo, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, my friend, I'm very glad to be here. It's an honor.
And the honor is all mine. I've been wanting to do a show about Latin America and specifically the white people of Latin America for a very long time. And now finally I have the chance to do it. And Leonardo, of course, will be joining us for the first hour of the show. For the second hour of the show, we have a guest from Brazil because I hear that there have been some interesting happenings in Brazil lately. But for the time being, it is Argentina Hour on the Writer's Block. And before we get into it, of course, we do have some crass financial concerns to address. Now, if you want to ask me questions, if you want to ask Leonardo questions, or if you just want to comment or donate to the Countercurrents fundraiser, you can always use Entropy. So it's entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen. And this is where you can give us your money, you can send us questions, and you can also use Cash App. That's cash.app/dollarcountercurrents. Now, of course, since we're streaming on DLive and Odyssey, you can also donate through DLive and Odyssey. You can give us all your lemons, your diamonds, your ninja guineas, ninjets, and even the elusive ice cream over on DLive. All these tokens, they're convertible to cash money. And with donations of diamond and higher, that's 100 lemons or higher, you can pose questions over on DLive. And over on Odyssey, you can donate either actual money, actual United States dollars, or you can give us a library coin, which is Odyssey's very own cryptocurrency, part of the Library Foundation. And they're useful. I mean, the conversion rate to money is not all that great, but we need Library Coin to keep the replays of these shows and other audio-video content produced by Countercurrents up on Odyssey. So, you know, every little bit helps. That's very useful to us. And, of course, those are the direct ways to donate to Countercurrents. Now, there is an indirect way to do it, and that is to purchase the fine products of our sponsor, Alaska Chaga. And here I am sipping their tea. Oh, it's still hot, but it is delicious. It is delicious. Now, some of you may know I was recently ill. I recently caught some unspecified rhinovirus, or may have been a cold, but now I'm back on my feet and in tip-top shape because, well, I've been drinking the Alaska Chaga. I attribute my good health and my handsome good looks to the Alaska Chaga. I did have to sacrifice my mustache for my good health as well, but you know it will always grow back. And of course, Alaska Chaga does not merely produce tea; it also produces soaps and other products. Powdered chaga, which I think you can use in your food as well, and it's good for you. It's got antioxidants. They scrape it off of the mulberry trees up in Alaska. And it's important to purchase real organic chaga from Alaska Chaga because otherwise, you know, the Chinese, they just grow the mushroom without synergizing it with the mulberry and beech trees. And so all of the benefits are lost. But that would be all of the crass financial concerns for today. I think that's enough of the begging for money. And so let's get into the show. Now, I invited Leonardo on tonight because recently, I hear Argentina has had some success in the sports area. They may or may not have won the football cup, the World Cup of Football. What was very interesting to me was that Argentina played France in the World Cup. And even though France is ostensibly a white country, the entire French team, except for the goalkeeper, were blacks and Arabs. Whereas Argentina, which is a country not in Europe, I wouldn't call it a non-European country, had a team which was, well, I wouldn't call it all white, but a lot of those guys looked white to me, and most of them actually looked white to me. And so I made some comments about Argentina's demographics, what is it, 55, 65, maybe more percent white. And I got a lot of pushback on that. And then I realized I don't really know much about Argentina's demographics. So I thought, you know, I'm going to fish around. I know a couple of guys from Latin America. Let's ask them. Let's bring on an Argentinian who is part of our movement, who shares our ideology, and who can educate us about Argentina. And so my friends put me in touch with Leonardo. So Leonardo, would you mind introducing yourself to the audience? What are you all about? Like, introduce yourself like there's people in the chat who've never heard of you.
Well, hello, people. Like I said, this is an honor to me. And I have a channel that I started not so long ago. First, I began with a blog in Blogspot, Blogger, and writing about the hidden things of the story of the wild race. The codifying symbols, the codifying myths, the codifying even music. I mean, I'm a historical researcher, cultural researcher, specialized in symbols, etymology, and ancient music. I currently have a project here in Argentina. I'm gathering donations to get a bagpipe, a special bagpipe, to make a cultural movement with flags and static and all that things to wake up people here, because people here is often disconnected from their roots, you know? And that's one of my dedication here. And I'm passionate about all that history that involves our race.
That is good to know. And sad to say, people are not disconnected from their roots only in Argentina, but all over the place, all over the white world. And part of our project here at the Writer's Block and as part of the broader Countercurrents organization is to reconnect people to their roots so that they remember what they are, so that they remember what their ancestors were and what they are to become. Now, our moderators are putting Leonardo's links all over the DLive and Odyssey chat so everyone can go and follow him on YouTube and Telegram and on Instagram. Now, it's in Spanish, I believe, but a lot of people speak or understand Spanish, so they can all follow Leonardo all over these social media, on Telegram, on YouTube, and on Instagram. We have Vig Bereiter in the chat. He has donated to Diamond. No comment, but we appreciate that, Diamond. Vig Bereiter, I love that name. I just love that name. Even though I'm so rusty in German, I forget what Vig Bereiter means. And so let's move into it. Leonardo, how white would you say Argentina is? Can you walk us through Argentina's historical demographics and its current demographics? Just paint a picture for us and speak to as if we know really nothing about Argentina.
Yeah, in recent years, recent decades, we have plenty of European descent. More like if, starting from maybe 1930s or a bit before, we have a lot of European immigration. And back in the day, before that, in ancient time, we have, well, the Spanish that came here. But way before that, we have a native population that were Caucasian, that were descendants from ancient people that were here before, Spanish, that were white. And people don't know that, but that history is often censored because they don't want to hear white people were here before the Spanish. But nowadays, tied in the first place, we have Spanish and Italians. That's the majority. And they are like, we have white people, mixed people, and Amerindians or native, whatever you want to say. white people are like 85% or something like that. It's a lot. We are not like the rest of Latin America. Same thing goes for our neighbors, Uruguay, the next country in the east. And in the third place, we have Germans. Fourth place, we have Russians. And we have Ukrainians, we have Poles, we have Bulgarians, we have Caucasian people from outside Europe, like Armenia, Turkey. We have a lot of Greeks. We have every country of Europe have a community here, and you can see that in the surnames. For example, my surname Heredia comes from Basque country. There is a tiny city that has this name, Heredia. So people often talk about Argentina. They don't know this. They don't know that most Argentinians came from Europe and from a Caucasian lineage. And that's important to talk about, because this was like always a refuge to them. In ancient time, they come seeking for work, seeking for place. We have a lot of land here that it will be able to be populated by them. We have a lot of build here. And this country was made by white people mainly. Yes, there is natives and mixed people, but the country was made by white people. Like it or not, it was like that.
Indeed. And of course, Argentina is, from what I've seen, I've never been, I hope to visit someday, but from what I've seen in media and over the internet, it seems like a wonderful country. Buenos Aires looks like a beautiful city. Now, you said Argentina is 85% white. That number seems much higher than a lot of people expect for Latin America. And I know there's a lot of prejudice in the West, in Europe, in North America about Latin America, but that, it's all indigenous. It's all got demographics like Mexico or something. But
Yeah,
that's not the case in Argentina. I ask you, when you say it's 85% white, in this 85% figure, do you include people who are maybe Castizo or Espomolo, or are we talking about people who are, 100 to maybe 95% white?
No, not Castizos, no, because they are considered mixed. So when I talk about white, I talk about white, like nothing of anything else. You maybe have one ancestor that had, I don't know, native or something else, but even in that case, it will be considered white because it doesn't show up. I mean, genetics don't manifest that thing.
Okay, because so, I've heard from a lot of Latin American people that Castizos are considered in some cases white enough, maybe not 100% white, but white enough. Is this the case in Argentina? What is the Argentinian attitude towards these questions?
Yeah, you could say so. But often the Castizos themselves talk about, I'm mixed and this is who I am. They don't have a problem with that. We don't have also a problem with that. Often the normal speak, the average Argentinian doesn't care about race. So that's why we need to talk about this, because we have a racial problem here and they are not aware of that.
That's interesting. And how would you characterize Argentina's racial problem?
The racial problem mainly comes from the extremely mixed people. that's what you say, that's what you know as the problematic. Those that are the ones that cause problems, they destroy things, they kill people, they rob, all that stuff. They always are the most genetical degenerates. They are ugly, they are, you know, they are like trash people.
Mm-hmm. Right, so you have a similar problem to what Americans experience from Mexicans or blacks, you would say.
Yeah, and we don't have blacks here. The blacks that are present here are not really a problem. They are good people. They don't cause any problem. They just sell watches on the street or sunglasses. They don't cause any trouble because they are like less than 1% here. But we need them to stay like that, because when we see the numbers rising, that will be a problem sooner or later, because the main problem here is not the mixed people, because the mixed people is a consequence of the Jewish leaders here. That's the main problem. We have one of the worst Jewish mafia here. Yeah, actually, we have. When you look at statistics, which is the city that has most Jews in the world? You have like Tel Aviv, New York, and Buenos Aires. Like in the first place, second place, or third place. We have a lot of them, and we have a lot of problems because of that. That's the main cancer that the country has.
And Argentina, it's facing immigration from countries with higher percentages of indigenous, I believe. Is it right?
Yeah, we have some, in recent years, we have some people from the north, from the Paraguay, from Peru, Chile, Venezuela, but that wasn't a big problem neither. They weren't too much. I mean, yeah, some of them came here to their sons to get born here and have the nationality, you know. But they're not the problem. I mean, we are still a lot of white people here. The main problem, as I repeat, are the Jewish with their politics, and people are starting to realize that slowly, but they are starting to realize.
So would it be more accurate to say that Argentina's situation is more similar to, let's say, a European country, that there aren't too many non-whites present? I mean, they're 15% non-whites is a large number, but not something excessive like, let's say, the United States of America or Mexico. And the main problem is a lack of will of the white population to assert their own right to a homeland and to engage in identity-based politics.
Yeah, exactly. White people are not aware of the roots, and in consequence of that, they are not, they don't have a strong identity to defend, you know? That's why my cultural movement promotes that awakening of, look, we have people here with flags and with music that I really like, and I want to know about them. And they will come and we will teach them. So that's how you need to start from the bottom, from the roots, you know, to have something to defend, have something to identify with. Because if you don't, belong to any people, you get infested by globalism and modernism, and you are lost. You are incomplete. You are in hands of the enemy. The enemy can manipulate you like whatever you want, whatever you want.
That is actually very well said. I have to ask you, the culture you are promoting, is it more of a return to European roots, or is it specifically Argentinian? I mean, obviously, it will be influenced by European culture, but are you trying to create something unique to Argentina in your work?
Exactly. I'm trying to make a culture that involves all the nations and tribes that we have here. So we need to dig on Europe. We need to dig. We need to bring a lot of Europe, of course. And we have already some folk culture here, but it doesn't identify everyone. You know, we have the gauchos, we have the culinary culture too. We have a lot of foods. We have some culture, but it's not enough. So we need to gather all and unite them. And the perfect thing to do is to go backwards in time to the ancient Scythians, because the ancient Scythians are the key to every white race, every Caucasian race, both in Europe and in Asia. Actually, Asia got its name from the Aesir, from the Aesir, the gods. And people are not aware of that story, and we have to talk about it. Because there are some white nationalists that say, oh, we didn't come from Asia. We are white people. Asia are just Mongoloid. That's not the case. That's not the case. We have a lot of evidence, archaeological evidence, proof, linguistic evidence that a lot of what we consider white people came from Asia. There is also white, blonde, tall mummies in China, for example. And they don't like to talk about that. But I know a lot of this. I've been researching. And we have the perfect opportunity to use all the European tribes and nations here. And the others that are not European, like Arabs, like Lebanon, like Syria, like Turkey, that we also have, they also shared some of that cultural heritage. So I've been studying a lot this, and I have a plan, and we need to do it, because we could wake up this country and make a powerhouse. Because we need uniting. We need to stop saying, oh, you're not this, you're not part of mine. Yeah, we are suffering the same things under the same territory, you know. And we have one enemy, and we know who they are. So we need to talk about everything without fear and make it happen.
That is well said. And of course, people know I follow Survive the Jive. He is great. He has spoken also about the Tarim Basin mummies in China, which were white people who had spread. They were called Tokarians, and they were exterminated by the Han Chinese. They were invaded and exterminated by the Han Chinese, even though much of what we call Han culture may be influenced by the Tokarians, so they may have inherited the Chinese a lot more from these people who were our racial kin in the Tarim Desert. But there is a lot to learn from archaeology about who we are and ultimately who we can become. White people have lost civilizational confidence all over the world, and historical research can help us regain our civilizational confidence.
Now, of course.
Right. I want to ask you, Leonardo, specifically, there is always this conflict in let's call them white colonies, you know, in America and Australia, and of course in Latin America, in Argentina and Chile, and all these places. Do you think that Do you think that you need to construct, of course, would you consider moving back to Europe, or do you believe that white people should remain in these countries which we have conquered and take their stands there?
Well, that's a good question, because I personally think that, for example, do you know Emma Lucy Shaw?
Yeah, I've heard of her,
He
yes.
was in Peru, and he, sorry, she had a lot of she had a need to return to England, so that was her case. I mean, she needed to go back, and that's perfect. But maybe some other people don't need to do that, because the most important thing is not really the place where you are, but your blood. I mean, your lineage. So it's a matter of the person itself. If he or she needs to do it, do it.
However, yes, from what I understand, Peru is a lot less white than a country like Argentina. So, I mean, I understand her decision to move back. I was asking really more about countries like Argentina, like the United States, like Australia, which are majority white and will remain so for at least some time.
Oh, yeah, I see.
I see this activism among people. Okay, America's lost, this place is lost, we have to return to Europe and take our stand there. However, I, as a European, I disagree with it, because that would mean Europe would first become very overpopulated, and second, because I think that the cultures of these overseas European settlements, like America, like Argentina, they're beautiful and unique, and they if these people were to move en masse to Europe, they would be erased. They would just be absorbed into the European cultures. And I just wanted to hear your stance on this. Do you think that our race is better off if white people continue to inhabit Argentina and develop culture, our culture there?
Well, that w like I said, Argentina was always a refuge for Europeans. So we have, like you say, a lot of places, like they are beautiful. They are just like Europe, you know? We have a lot of forests, we have mountains, we have a lot of beautiful places that they look like, for example, Alpine region of Germany, for example. We have a lot of German colony here in Argentina, in the north and the south, and they are what they are. I mean, it doesn't matter where you are, because your genes will manifest and create what you always were. You know, you maybe have some nostalgia from the ancient lands of Europe. But the most important thing is not the place, but your blood. So, like I said, if someone wants to return, that's okay. If someone wants to escape the chaos in Europe, can come over here. They will have economic problems, because we have we have the Jews on the leader seat, so economy will be bad. But you can do something. You can create here. You can do. You can be. But you need to be aware of those problems, those politics problems mainly. So yeah, they can come. So, and because of my movement, that will be very good, because we need a lot of warriors. They actually, a lot of Russians have came to Argentina to their sons to get born here. So some Aryan warriors are born here.
That's very interesting. Now, Let's talk a little bit about the politics of Argentina. You mentioned that you have the problem with the Jews, with Buenos, they are like a mafia in Buenos Aires. Have they instituted any egregiously anti-white policies which hamper the development and well-being of white people in Argentina? And I'm sure they have, if you would just describe them for us.
Yeah, that was not a really strong program of them, but it is. They often use the same weapons like they use in all the world. The media, the propaganda media, mainly is because of that, or movies to promote an anti-military, anti-guns, anti-identity. For example, they like to say that we Argentinians are all brown. We are brown. Like we are all mixed. We are not white. We are, but that's not the reality. But the good thing is, Argentina often, the average Argentinians, like I said, just don't care about race. They don't care. So they don't give a fuck about those propaganda, and they struggle here. I mean, we have good points to use to like a resource. I mean, if your people don't care about race, the enemy wants to tell you, oh, you are brown, you're not white. The white I don't care says, I mean, I don't care. What are you saying? It doesn't have any effect. That's a good thing. But
Yes, but on the other
they are.
hand, yeah.
Yeah, they need to invest all the potential of the white people all in the world. They have done that in the past. Look what happened with Persia. Look what happened with India. Look what happened in the Balkans. They made war. They divided every people. They do the same in every place because they need to get rid of white people in the world. That's why Argentina is infested with Jews. Because they know this is a powerful country. We have everything here. We have all the resources that you want. We have sea. We have oil. We have minerals, metals. We have the jungle. We have steppe. We have desert. We have everything, everything. And they want all of it. They want all of it. And they are selling our country to private millionaires. So that's a problem. But we are in time to take some action. That's why I have this project, this cultural and musical project to wake up. We
That
need
is
to
very
do
interesting.
a calling for the blood to start awakening and being aware of who you are. Yeah, right?
That is a very good approach, actually, to awaken the blood through music. I wish more of our guys were doing it. I mean, I'm privy to a couple of projects which are going on behind the scenes, musical projects in the white nationalist movement, which will probably get the blood running. But for that, in some future episode of the Writer's Block. And I want to ask you, Leonardo, are there any political parties or organizations in Argentina which advocate for white people?
We have none. There are some kind of, but they don't like to talk about race, and that's a huge problem because they are like controlled dissidency. They are fake, and people are not aware of that. So that's why I started my own because there was nothing to get involved to. They use like the same old story. They have left and right the same thing to divide, and we need to cut it out. We have some maybe a nationalist way in some party, but it's not really nationalist. It's not really. They are tied to the Jewish mafia also. So it is like a facade.
Great. And are there any organizations maybe connected with the Catholic Church which could be useful for white people in Argentina?
Oh, no, Catholic Church can be used to that. No. That's totally, Catholic Church is totally anti-white.
Right, the church is anti-white, you would say, in Argentina specifically, and probably more.
No, broadly. Not in Argentina, not all over the world. I mean, Christianity is not compatible with our history or race.
Right. And since, you know, the Pope is now Argentinian, I guess that's, I guess your experience with the Catholic Church is actually relevant globally right now. Personally, I have been greatly disappointed by Christianity in the past couple of years, even though I know I still call myself a Christian.
You should return to your old traditions, I think.
I respect the old traditions. I think a lot of them are contained within the Christian and folk ritual of our people. This is, you know, why I'm very reluctant to reject the Christian faith, because I think it's a repository of wisdom and tradition which is still relevant in this day and age.
They have a lot of good things, you know, but all those good things were of pagan origin. All the good morals were of pagan origin. But you need to know that Christianity was made by Jews, using all that good morals and symbols and history and cult to make Europeans identify with, so they can control them, you know? So it is a sneaky psyop. Sneaky, very sneaky.
Right. Okay. That's your position. And I mean, there is, I would say, that's a topic for a different show.
Of course.
Now, I have here a donation from the audience for $3 on Odyssey. Dino Legovic, he writes in and he says, Leonardo, I've been studying ancient Egypt. Are Basques and the language related to ancient Egyptians? Have you heard of such theories?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. Yes, I can confirm it, but they have been a really good reason to hear that. I mean, Basque is a really enigmatic language. I don't have proof of its ties to Egyptian, but I have proof with a strong connection with Armenian, with Basque. And that's very interesting. I have an article to share. So there's proof that Caucasians have a connection with the west of Europe.
So there is a linguistic connection between the Armenian and Basque language.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I had never heard of it. I've never heard of that. You're going to have to send me that article. I'm going to have to read it later because that sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it will be a pleasure.
I always thought about Basque as a language isolate, although in my research of Latin America, I found out that Latin America, and not only Latin America, but also Quebec, is disproportionately Basque. There's a lot more Basques as a proportion of the population of Spanish America and French America than there is as a proportion of the populations of Spain and France. I guess it's because the Basque, they're an adventurous people and they were wealthier than average. I've heard some theories that after the Spanish Inquisition got rid of the Jews in Spain, the Basques took over a lot of their professions, right? The middleman minority type professions. And of course, they conducted them without the Jewy behavior. And this is why Spain prospered, because of the Basques. And this would be interesting because in the Eastern Mediterranean, we have this joke that, you know, trust a snake before a Jew, trust a Jew before a Greek, but never trust an Armenian. So if Armenians are Basques, that's going to be very interesting if they're related, because they have this sort of mercantile history, both nations, both Armenians and Basques. I'm going to have to read and more about that to see if I believe it, because it is a little difficult to believe. You know, Armenia and Basque, they're very so far away. I don't think I've ever heard that there is a linguistic connection between Armenia and Basque.
It is hard to believe, but when you get inside the rabbit hole about Scythians, you know, you start to realizing that a lot of our history is not told, and they were from that region, from the North Caucasia and the region of the Black Sea, and they moved along because they were nomads. And we have also I don't remember the name, but the Pasiegos on Spain have the same name as some people in that region too. So we have also, if you look at old maps, you have the name Iberia in the Caucasian region. So that's the same name as
probably
Iberian.
Talking about the Pechenegs.
Pechenegs, yes. Pechenegs are the Pasiegos.
Yes, but the Pechenegs, they're a Turkic people.
And exactly.
Yes, but Pecheneg is an exonym. I think it's Greek. It comes from Greek batsinagos, which means what was it? Oh God, husband of the sister of the wife's sister. It's maybe the two words come from the same Greek root, but who knows?
It could be, yes, but it is the proof, the cultural proof, the cultural heritage is there, because often people think about Scythians and they say, oh, they were Iranians, right? They were Aryans, and that's not all. That's not 100% true, because Scythians had a lot of Turkic elements. So my conclusion about that is that Scythians originated both Aryans and Turkic culture, and they were white. But they go in different ways in history.
It's interesting because most Turkic peoples today and historically in the Middle Ages are Central Asian.
Exactly.
Yeah, but they are, you know, they look like Central Asians. They have, you know, eyes, yellow
mixed
skin.
Yes.
So this is all due to mixing?
Yeah, the original Turks were white. I'm 100% sure, because when you see Magyars or Hungarians, they told us that they came from that region and they are white, you know. And the same from Iberians or the Pasiegos or Basques. They are white. They are not mixed. So the mixing happened in the branch that stay in Asia. But originally, they were white.
That's very interesting.
Hungarians are a very, this is well known. They are Scythian descendants, and they are white. So how they should be looking like Asia? They should be looking Mongolian, and that's not the case.
Yeah, I've been to Hungary and nobody there looks Mongolian. They look very, very white. They look like they look like the people who live around them. They look like Germans. They look like Slovaks. They look like Croatians. They don't look like Mongols.
Exactly. That's why I say the original Turks were white, often with blonde, blue eyes, red hair, light brown, just like white people nowadays.
That's an interesting theory. It's going to be very controversial, I have to tell you that, because like I said, most of the peoples who who speak Turkic languages today, like Uzbeks and Kazakhs and all of these people, the Turkmen, they look Asiatic. Some are Caucasian, and they're like a mixture between white, Asian, and Middle Eastern, like the Azerbaijanis. And then you have the Turks of Turkey, which is completely different discussion, right?
Yeah, well, we are not talking about those of nowadays. We are talking about, I'm talking about the originals. So if you look at Mongolia, the people of Mongolia, they have a lot of mixed people. You know, you can see that they have Caucasian features, you know, and you wonder why, because there were a white population there before. And you have that proof from China with the mummies. And it's important to talk about this, because the same thing happened in India, like I said, happening in all Middle East. We have some of them surviving, like the Hansa people or the Kalash people in Afghanistan, I think, or Pakistan. I don't remember. There are some survivors that they are not Islamics. Their religion, their pagan religion, survived. And they are look often Caucasian and white. So there is a long forgotten history of our people there.
The Hunzas in particular, they claim descent from Alexander and from the Greco-Bactrians. So
That's not the case.
You doubt it?
That's a myth. No, that's a myth that is often repeated, but it's not true, because they were like that way before.
It's interesting because the prince of the Hunza people came here to Macedonia maybe 10, 15 years ago and proclaimed that they were descendants of Alexander. But I don't know.
This
is very interesting.
That's not true. Because yeah, a lot of people. It happened with the North African Amazigh, the most commonly known as Berbers. The Berbers or Amazigh originally descend from that population from the Middle East, and they look like white people, green eyes, blue eyes, red hair, blonde hair. They are not Arabs. They are not. They are neither the Visigoths. It's not the. Often you can find someone who says like, oh, they are the Vandals or something like that. The same thing with Alejandro, but it's not the case. They are older. And they share the same clothes, the same symbols. You need to pay attention and see that they share a lot of culture. So they came from the same tree.
That's very interesting. Now we have donations over on DLive. Slug has donated 14 lemons, and thank you for that, Slug. And okay, kitos setruesta, as your people say. And I have a question. There is no donation attached, but I think it's important to answer. From Lepro 8, and he says, I hear parts of Argentina are very violent. Which group is committing the violence?
Yeah. Like I said, the main problem here is the robbers, the mixed people. Those are the most violent. For example, I was walking with my girlfriend in the forest, and we were attacked with they used some kind of machete to scare and something like that. I couldn't defend myself because I was carrying a heavy backpack, so I couldn't do anything, and they steal my cell phone. And when we go to the police to try to identify those robbers, I came across with all the registry of the arrested people, you know, and all of them, 100%, they were all ugly or mixed, all trash people, you know, like you see someone like that in the street and you run away because that's not I mean, you need to do some prejudice, you know. And that's the reality. That's not biased.
Yeah. It's important to have these instincts. Like I say to a lot of people, racism is evolutionarily adaptive. If you are racist, you know, and you avoid people of other races, indigenous, you know, like Indians, blacks, Arabs, you're going to avoid a lot of trouble. You're going to avoid a lot of crime. If you're anti-Semitic, so you don't go into business with Jews, you're not going to get scammed. You're not going to get defrauded. These things are adaptive, right? These are good for us. They are defense mechanisms, like our immune system is a defense mechanism. Our immune system, our skin, it defends us against diseases. And our racism and anti-Semitism, they protect us from crime. Because these people are criminal. They like to take advantage of us. White people, we have this drawback that we have high trust communities. We have communities which depend on people trusting each other. And this is just the way we are. I don't think we can change it. What we can change is we can redefine who is part of the community and who isn't. And we have to insert these racial outsiders. We have to make sure that our people stop trusting them, that we stop thinking about them as one of us, that we start treating them as the outsiders they really are, both the mixed, the blacks and the Jews, all of these violent and deceptive people.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that 100%, because racism was always natural. You know, you can say that every one of them is bad and a bad person, but you need to take care. You need to take some precautions. You know, it is good to say it like that, or.
Right.
You need to be cautious.
We live in a world where basically we cannot afford to be careless anymore. I have an article up on Countercurrents about basically how walking around with my headphones listening to music or podcasts in the street, and I'm walking around wearing flip-flops, you know, not dressed for fighting. It's a privilege of living in a homogenous and safe society. If I were living in America or some other place where you have racial aliens performing violent crimes, I wouldn't be walking around like that. That is a privilege Americans don't have, unfortunately. And
yeah, totally.
Okay, Leonardo, we have about 5 minutes left, well, six actually, of your segment. So if you would give us some closing remarks and tell the audience where they can find you, where they can follow and support your work.
Well, I have a channel on YouTube that is called El Fuego del Khan, like Genghis Khan, and the same name in Telegram. And the cultural movement that I need to start, I'm about to start, is called Amanecer Rojo. That it means red dawn, because mm-hmm. We have a red sun over a black flag that symbolizes our heart, our blood that awakens and shines in darkness, so we can see who we are and who we want to be. So those are my pages. And in the near future, I will be translating some things, and some of your followers may want to help to do this, because I have important information from the English speaking people that involves the white race in these regions in all America. So that will be very good to work together to bring this story to the English speaking world.
Yes, it is a shame that there are so few resources in English about about the white people of Latin America, of South America, and that a lot of white people, you know, from Europe and America, because we primarily learn about the world in the English language, we just don't know, we cannot learn, so we are somewhat ignorant about your part of the world. I'm trying to change this, and of course now we have people who are bilingual working for this project. We can educate people about Argentina and about the rest of Latin America, so it's not all bad. So I want to thank you, Leonardo, for appearing tonight on the Writer's Block, and now I think I can let you go. Bye-bye.
Then take care. Bye-bye. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye. And with that, I can... hold on a second. I'm going to bring in V. Now, V is a mysterious figure who comes to us from Brazil. And V, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well so far. I mean, had a few problems earlier today, but nothing that really you guys should be concerned about. It's fine.
Right. Of course, in these difficult times, we stick together, and I'm really, really happy that you've made this disappearance. I know that you've had a difficult day, and I appreciate, nevertheless, you coming here to tell us about Brazil. And of course, you are Brazilian, and you have elected to come to the Writer's Block and tell us a little bit about what's going on in your country. So let's begin with that. Recently, there were elections in Brazil, and of course, President Jair Bolsonaro was defeated, but he claims that the elections were stolen. What would you say is the story there?
Well, it's absolutely true. There's even evidence from a few independent sources regarding the validity of these voting machines. They're all like made by Smartmatic, which is from Venezuela. You know, like it's already like a big problem. We do not have a paper ballot at all. It's completely sort of illegal. We switched to the electronic voting system a long time ago, and for like a big part of this, like the elections are stolen or not, is basically the movements. So just like with Biden, we could see that Bolsonaro's appearances and everything, he was like gathering crowds of almost like millions of people. Even like the protests running up to the elections were massive. And when you look at Lula, he had maybe like 50, 100 people going there, and they're known for like paying people to be at these events. So it's complicated to say that, oh, he had more support and everything. The thing is, several inconsistencies were also seen during the counting process, which is broadcast as almost live as everything. But, for example, Northeast Brazil, which is the most historically leftist, let's say, region in Brazil, I guess, they always finish their counting last, which usually lets them sort of cancel one area or another that's basically like winning for Bolsonaro. And that's how basically every election has been going for, I guess, like almost 20 years or so, with Bolsonaro being actually a big surprise for us.
Now, of course, you would say that the elections were rigged. And how did President Bolsonaro and his supporters react to that?
Well, the thing is, before the election, like 2 years ago or something, he tried to make two projects to change the voting system. Not to make it like paper ballots as it should be, because it's harder to fraud that way, but his attempt was to have a verifiable voting ballots, because these voting machines, they are made by a Venezuelan company, and they can't be, there is no possibility of a recount, for example. They can't be audited, they can't be, there is no security other than the government saying, oh yeah, it's safe, you know. So he tried to make it so there would be like a small printer that would print your vote, show it to you on a glass thingy, sorry, like a duct, and your vote would fall into a ballot box. That would be able to verify and everything. So what happened is that the Supreme Court, for some reason, started lobbying in Congress to stop this project from passing in Congress. And they had several meetings with party leaders and even like the Congress heads and everything to prevent this this project, this law to pass. And that was like a major defeat. And from then on, we already knew that something was up. And not long after that, they also released Lula from jail. So we were all like, most like realistic people were like, okay, they are going like too far to not rig the elections. So, and that's basically what happened. Nobody like accepted it, but everyone was waiting for either Bolsonaro to do something and somehow overturn the elections, or the military, as many like boomers expect, to save us, to go there and I don't know, like take power. And I don't know, they just expected the military to do something and nothing happened.
And of course, people, I believe, gathered in the capital of Brasilia to protest, and you know, these stolen elections, and on January the 8th, prompting a lot of parallels with January the 6th, 2021 in the United States. Now, if you would tell our audience, if you would walk our audience through what happened on January 8th, 2023 in Brasilia.
Okay, so it was a pretty interesting event, I guess we could say that. So just as the United States won, the government was notified by our intelligence agencies. It's called ABIN here. And they basically said, like, I think it was like 3 days prior, that something of that size was going to happen, like hundreds of thousands of people and everything. And also the state security head and everything, everyone involved in the security of that district basically did nothing. From the police, from the federal police and everyone else who usually, for demonstrations of people from the right wing, they sometimes like put like a lot of fences and ton of security and everything. Nothing of that was in place on that very day. So
here's
that was
a question.
Big weird.
Brasilia is not part of any Brazilian state. It's a federal district like DC, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It was a planned city. It's completely planned out. It was not something organic. It was built to be the center of the government, everything there. So other than that, what happened was a lot of people went there. Everyone was mad as hell because if you look at what's going on in Brazil, we have one single justice from the Supreme Court basically arresting everyone. He is canceling passports of people who are sometimes abroad the country already, like journalists, because they criticize the government, they question the elections, and they, according to them, they attack the institutions. So for them, that's, I don't know, like a crime or something, despite not being the constitution of the country or any law, other law. So people basically entered the buildings. There is rumors of several infiltrators just as the in USA, but for the most part, the protesters there, they sort of did a good job. For the most part, the people went there to sort of occupy the building. I don't know what the reasoning was, the main reasoning, but for as for the government, they they tried at first to take people out. They started throwing like tear gas grenades and everything. It didn't matter much because there was just a lot of people going to all three buildings. That was probably, I mean, I would calculate something like 80,000 people or more. So it's really like a huge mass of people to stop with just like tear gas or anything like that. And I mean, people basically unloaded their frustrations, some of them. And other people there were identified as being something like suspicious, you know, like people with like colored hair and, you know, that sort of thing. So there's also the theory that this was part of a government, let's say, strategy to end these protests, because ever since the elections, there's a bunch of people like camping in front of military headquarters, demanding the military to sort of intervene and take down like the Supreme Court and everything, the thing that basically like destroying the country. So as soon as Lula entered White House, let's say, the Planalto, we saw like several of his ministers and everything, several officials saying that they really want to end that, like take everyone from the like prohibit those camps and everything. The army didn't let them because it's, you know, it's legal. You can't protest anything you want. So they tried their best. It failed. So that's also another theory why they didn't do anything, because it would give them the excuse to say that whoever's protesting is, I don't know, like anti-democracy or anything, and would give them every excuse to take everyone from like every city, because that this is happening like nationwide from those headquarters.
It's interesting. Now, you mentioned that 80,000 people gathered in Brasilia and, you know, entered these three buildings: the building of the Congress, the Supreme Court, and what was the third one?
It's the Supreme Court. It's the Congress itself. The Congress actually has two buildings inside of it, but it's sort of like it's difficult to sort of explain. But it's two buildings. Is the three powers, we call it, like, because it basically has a Senate, the Congress, the Senate, the House, and the Supreme Court in basically a single square. It's all the same street.
Right. And, right, so 80,000 people, they entered these buildings, the riot police couldn't stop them, and still, you know, they failed in accomplishing anything concrete. And, I mean, people have commented that this is very similar to January 6th in America. And in both cases, you had people who had power, you know, who had the ability to enter these buildings and seize these places of government. But once they did, they had no idea what to do with them. They had no organization and they had no leadership. Now, I want to ask you, to what extent do you think Jair Bolsonaro was involved with in planning this protest, this incursion? And do you think he could have benefited from it even if he had planned them?
No. I think Bolsonaro had absolutely nothing to do with it. He was in Miami, actually. He's been there since before Lula got in power, because he didn't want to take part into like officially handing over the country to a criminal, like actual criminal. So he's not like asking people to protest or anything. When he was in power back in like, I don't know, like November, December, people were already like, let's block the roads, like go on a general strike and everything. And Bolsonaro, especially regarding the roads, which was something that was like disrupting a lot of things, because you cut supply lines, you cut people from going from one city to another to work or whatever. And he himself told his supporters to not block roads because that was illegal and it violated people's rights of movement and everything. which is in the constitution. So Bolsonaro tries to be as neutral and I wouldn't say democratic, but he tries to be the good guy at all times. So even if it costs him like his power and everything, he just wants to be the scout, the Boy Scout, you know. He doesn't, I don't think he would like even get in power if people took down the current government, because there's no provisions in the law to let Bolsonaro take power. The only way to do that would be if the military somehow intervened, took down the whole Congress, the Supreme Court and everything, and then appointed him, which wouldn't happen because for those who don't like follow Brazilian politics a lot, the first ministers that were appointed by Bolsonaro when he was elected were generals from the armed forces, because he, as a retired colonel, he has a lot of faith in them, you know, like they're like sort of like brothers in arms and everything. So sadly, also through that, we found out that a lot of the generals and everyone in the armed forces, a lot of people, really, really a lot of people there in high places, are actually leftists, like raging leftists. Some generals were registered as Communist Party voters and everything. So they were the first to betray him. And of course, they wouldn't save him now. His chances to do whatever he had to do was like in the first year when he got in power, before the Supreme Court started intervening on everything, interfering on everything.
That's interesting. There is this contrivance, I think, among right-wing people that the militaries of the various countries of the world are on their side. I don't know why. I don't know. I mean, to me, it's very clear these people draw a salary from the government. Many times they themselves are brainwashed. There is, I would say, disproportionate leftist brainwashing at military academies, precisely because our enemy knows that the militaries could be a threat to them. So yes, the officer corps is leftist, even though, you know, the rank and file soldier may be, you know, right-wing in a general sense. And even the right-wing generals, they're right-wing really in this conservative Fox News conservative sense, which is not helpful. Now, speaking of Fox News conservatives, a lot of people in the white nationalist movement are criticizing Jair Bolsonaro because, well, he's not really a racial thinker, is he? And he's very close to the Israelis. He's very pro-Israel. Would you mind commenting on that a little bit?
Well, yeah. In Brazil, there's like no real racial thinking as in I'd say like a country saving ideology, for example. Maybe you have something similar like in South Brazil or something like that, where you had like later immigration from places like Italy and Germany a lot. So you have, for example, the largest German community outside of Germany, if I'm not mistaken, is in South Brazil in a city called Joinville. It's a pretty cool city. You go there, there's people like talking German everywhere. Some small towns in like countryside South Brazil, people speak more German than Portuguese on a daily basis. Like they among themselves, they don't speak Portuguese, for example. So it's pretty hard. The rest of the country, our colonization and everything, it didn't let us have like a big, let's say, definition between a lot of people. You know, there's of course like the people who are mestizos or castizos, as we call them, like the different mixes. They are sort of like you can spot them, you know. But we never got to develop some sort of a unity think against like, oh, this group is bad or this group is good, you know, because the creation of the Brazilian identity in around 1919, if I'm not mistaken, when the Republic was declared, which was also a coup. They tried to distance Brazil as much as possible from Europe or anything related to Europe. So you basically created this identity of an actual melting pot. So a lot of people don't think of themselves as whites or whatever, because to be very honest with you, most people here are gonna have like at least like 20% mixed DNA or something, unless you're from like very recent immigration places or your parents just came from outside. So it's hard to say, oh, I want like whites only Brazil. That's impossible here. But Bolsonaro, for the most part, he really doesn't look at it that way, precisely because he also is like very scared of being like the bad guy, you know. Just as people like ask him to, oh, do this, do that, or tell the military to arrest a Supreme Court justice, which he could have done, but it would have put him in the, oh, he's a dictator spot, you know, despite already being called that. So he would rather not do that. And as regards to Israel, Brazil never had much of a problem with Israel itself. We had more problems with Palestinians when Lula was in power previously. They made an embassy here, and during a few protests, they went there and tried to stab people. People almost lynched these Palestinians who went there, and the whole debacle started. But Bolsonaro was pretty close with Israel, mostly because they have technology that could be applied to us, especially in the northeast Brazil, which is for the lack of a better words, like a very miserable region in regards to resources. They're almost a desert or savanna. So Israeli technology for irrigation and something like that could help the region to overcome a few problems they have had for, like, I don't know, 200 years, because they're honestly too lazy to build like water reservoirs or whatever. So Bolsonaro was basically thinking in Brazil. He wasn't focusing on like anything else. He's the most stereotypical conservative boomer you could find out there, you know.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Now, you talk a lot about Brazilian demographics. I'm interested in this. We know that there's a lot of indigenous in Brazil, but there's also a lot of blacks. At least 5 million black slaves were imported into Brazil, unless I'm very much mistaken with my history. And Brazil is also a very big country, now fifth largest in the world by both population and area, which is, you know, interesting to know. Can you give us a breakdown of Brazilian demographics, and preferably by region, right? Because we understand this is probably a majority non-white country, but some places are, well, you know, you could say almost 90% white, from what I understand.
So basically, we have Northeast Brazil, which is the darkest region in the country. They had the most slaves from Africa, and they also had a lot of natives. So there's a ton of mixing from between like Indians and Africans, and also the colonizers and everyone else. So there was also something special about the Northeast Brazil, is that the Dutch tried to sort of create their own thing there, but it didn't work. They were sort of like kicked out, and but there's still some Dutch heritage there, like blood, not actually like culturally on it or anything. The Northeast destroys anything that touches there, and it's impossible to actually be there. So it's the Northeast is also the poorest, most like inbred, those are actual data, the most illiterate and poorest region in the country. For the most part, the problem in Brazil for most regions, including my city and most big cities in the country, are that Northeasterns, just like, I don't know, like Mexicans or whatever, they don't try to fix their region. Their region is always poor. They keep voting for leftists, as I mentioned before, and they just keep doing whatever they were doing, like for, I don't know, 80 years, and the situation keeps getting worse. So they simply move out, and they move to basically anywhere else they could, from São Paulo to South Brazil and Midwest Brazil, which is where I live. And they are like the bane of Brazil, honestly. Northern Brazil is mostly, I'd say, indigenous. They are mostly like mixed with indigenous people. The number of white people in both North and Northeast Brazil are very, very small. Like, I'd be surprised if it was like 30 or 20% for real. So, the North Brazil, some regions are also extremely violent, but not as violent as Northeast. Some states manage to not be as poor, but the vast majority of them are far below living standards in other areas, like such as others, like regions in Brazil, as usual. So Midwest is where I live, mostly white people, I'd say, but I told you before, I can tell you we have like 80% like pure blood white people here. You know, I'm a descendant of Europeans myself, and I probably have some mystery African or whatever DNA in there, because it's hard to control those things in Brazil. But basically my region, it was sort of colonized later. We were in around the 1800s, 1900s. The region was to mine metal, gold, and everything. So it was like a later colonization. We barely had slaves and everything. So most people here, I'd say, are white or a bit brown, because there was like Indian tribes here and some slaves, so the mixing
So at
existed.
most, you would say castizo, right?
Yeah, I
Maybe a
guess so.
quarter indigenous.
Yeah, it's hard to say because, as I told you before, like we had later immigration, so we had some Indians that were mixing, but for the most part, it was people from other states that were coming here. So at the time, we had also like Italians moving into Brazil, so there's like a very big difference in this area where I live. So, but I'd say that like the vast majority of people would be white. It's changing a bit lately because the Northeasterns and North people are moving here, but it's still like mostly white. People from my city in special, they tend to avoid people from other regions, and we can spot them easily. Like it's like the racism you just mentioned. We see them, like they look, especially people from Northeast, they look a bit weird, you know, like their phenotype is very specific. If you live here, you can spot them from afar. So we just like say nope and go somewhere else. And but I guess at best we have like a lot of castizos and a lot of whites too. Blacks and brown people in my state are very, very little. In the region itself, since it's very rural, like the economy basically spins around like agriculture and everything, cattle. So they don't want to come here. There isn't much to do here. We are considered like the Brazilian Texas, I guess. So you won't see like the Northeasterns who don't want to work coming here. So Southeast Brazil, which is São Paulo, Minas, Rio de Janeiro, and Espírito Santo, it's a predominantly white region, because they not only had the most colonization from the Portuguese and everything, they also had the most immigration. So Germans, Italians, and Japanese, and everyone else who was coming to Brazil in the, I don't know, like 20s to all the way to the 60s, I guess, they were all going to São Paulo or Rio. So you have a lot of like new blood coming in all the time. And São Paulo, for example, has the largest Japanese community outside of Japan in the world. I think we also, São Paulo also has the largest Italian community outside of Italy, or had a few years ago. And that's something that changed a bit the city. You know, São Paulo as a state, it's considered almost like a different country. It's a different economy and everything else. It's a lot industrial, very, very industrial. So for the most part, I'd say São Paulo is like 70% white or castizo or something like that. So much so that an American, like a diversity authority, or I don't remember her name, she came to São Paulo and asked where were all the black people? Because she expected actually like a city of like a lot of brown people, black people everywhere. But São Paulo, for the most part, is not like that. Unless you go to like the favelas or something, very like in the outskirts of the city, where people of like poor social status, they usually live from, even if they come from like other regions, or if they are just like the descendants or of some slave or tribe. You won't find a lot of like black people in São Paulo in general. Rio has a lot more like black people, mostly because of the slaves, of course, and also because the favelas have like the size of a favela you see in the pictures is not like you don't imagine it's gonna be massive. But the population living inside those areas, sometimes it's equal to like a whole city. You know, it's a city within a city, like within a city, like I don't know, like 300,000 people. We're talking like several favelas of 300,000 people or something. So it's very, very big, and that population usually tends to not be white. You know, so. We, as usual, we can spot them, we avoid them and everything, and that saves us a lot of trouble. Especially like it's like when you go to America and you see someone wearing like ghetto clothes and everything, you're gonna avoid them. For the Brazilian, we kind of know the style, so as soon as we see someone, you know, like kind of brown using certain clothes, we just avoid them a little bit. Especially in Rio, which is like extremely violent as a city. Like it's extremely violent. I do not recommend people who never came to Brazil, for example, to go to Rio alone. It's not like the average European city with just like your scammer and everything. It's very, very dangerous, especially at night.
But
So.
you can walk around, say, São Paulo, right? No problem. Like, it's a
Well,
safer city.
depends a lot. Depends a lot. São Paulo, it's a massive city. I'll compare it with New York or let's see, another big city, Los Angeles, because it's very industrialized. But at the same time, because it also has favelas, not as violent as Rio, but it also has favelas. It also has like cartels operating everywhere. So you have to be aware of your surroundings. It's something like most tourists and foreigners in general, they don't have this mentality anymore, because you live in like Europe or America and you're safe. You're usually safe. For the most part, you don't consider that if you were walking around, you could be a victim of a crime or anything. And if you think so, there's always like a police officer somewhere to help you. So in Brazil, it's not like that, and you have to pay attention, you know, not bring attention to yourself, like being like with big chains and everything, jewelry. That's not very good to walk around, especially in Rio and São Paulo. São Paulo, it's more like, depending on the neighborhood you are, you can walk around like no worries, you know. But depending if you like downtown São Paulo, there's like we call it Cracolândia, which is basically like a street or a square where like crackheads basically took over. So there's like a lot of traffic, there's like criminals everywhere, and it's like it's the middle this it's in the middle of the city. Sometimes you're just walking around, you like enter the wrong street, and there's a lot of criminals there. That's something to be aware about, Brazil.
And of course, this is South Brazil we are talking, which is majority white, from what I
No,
understand.
this is
No,
Southeast. That's
Southeast.
Southeast is basically Rio, São Paulo, Espírito Santo, which nobody hears about, and Minas Gerais. Minas Gerais is also it's a big state, actually. Most foreigners don't hear a lot about it, but it's like mostly rural also. My state has a lot of like influence from Minas, and it's mostly white also. Like a lot of Italians and people from like other areas move there because of the general possibility of buying land and everything. And back in the day, they used to develop a lot of it, so they grew a lot of like coffee bean farms and everything. Minas Gerais was extremely important back in the day.
Okay, and South Brazil, anything to say
Well,
about that?
South Brazil is actually, if I'm honest, it's my favorite place in the country. Basically, the vast majority of the population is white, and when I say white, is like nearly German. Like we have sometimes our last names are mistyped and everything, but for the most part, the average person in South Brazil is on average a lot taller than the average in other regions, like my region, and especially like Northeast Brazil, where people are very short. So you have tall people, a lot of blonde people. You'll see like a lot of like last names that are German or Italian because they had a lot of it. They had like I would say that most of the Italian and German immigration went to South Brazil, and in particular the German one was like a populational boom in South Brazil because the weather is a bit nicer and everything. It was a very underdeveloped region at the time, so the Germans fleeing Germany, some were like Nazi officers and everything, they went there to hide. And since there was already like several communities at the time, other Germans ended up going there too, because why not? So the vast majority there is white. The number of like black people in the region are like very, very small. That has been changing a bit lately because people from Northeast have been moving there to look for jobs and everything. Something they have even been making fun about lately because the Northeast voted like massively for Lula, and the South voted for Bolsonaro, and they're like playing something like, "Oh, okay, so you vote for Lula and move here to look for jobs, right? Nice." And there's the whole thing. South Brazil also tried to in the past, you know, that it's not allowed, but just like the U.S., they tried to secede. Because South Brazil has, they see themselves as, I wouldn't say independent, but they see themselves as self-sufficient. Because the region produces a lot of like natural resources, I'd say. Like it's also agricultural, very agricultural from both like plants and cattle. So the region can sustain itself. It has a high income. It produces a lot of money. And they have tried before to secede because they see themselves as being, let's say, that they're being leached out by the government, because South Brazil basically sends money out in taxes to the Brazilian government, doesn't get much help in exchange. And for the most part, they in Southeast Brazil produce the most money. So they think, well, why should we stay as part of Brazil when we have like our own culture and everything? And they like don't help us at all. We just send money and never get anything in return.
Do you think that this recent stolen election and the frustration of the efforts of Bolsonaro supporters are going to restart a secessionist movement in South and southeastern Brazil? Because that's some one thing I was thinking about. In America, people are dispersed and the divide is mostly rural versus urban, right? I mean,
No,
there
no,
is red
no.
state and blue state, but in Brazil, from what you're trying, as you're telling me, white people and Bolsonaro supporters are concentrated in the south and southeast. So, do
Yeah,
you think?
everything out of Northeast Brazil is Bolsonaro ground, like every single state, and the only areas that actually vote for Lula in Minas Gerais, for example. Which is a very big country, usually like very decisive. In Minas Gerais was the north part of the country, the state. That part of the state in particular has a lot of people from Northeast Brazil living there. So there's this whole anti-northeastern, northern Brazilian movement growing again. It was something like was pretty big before, but it's growing again. The secession movements, they have returned also, but since it's absolutely legal even to make a campaign for that, that's just not gonna go anywhere. It's just like something people want, but it's not gonna happen. Especially because differently from the US, we cannot have like a lot of guns. We cannot form like militias independently, and that's if we do, that's completely illegal. So there's just no fucking way it's going to go anywhere.
Okay, so those are my hopes for a new country popping up in South America dashed. I want to ask you the white population of Brazil. What is the demographic breakdown there? How many are do you think are Portuguese? How many are German? How many Italian?
Oh man, that's a pretty hard question. I don't know, man. Honestly, every region has its like has a different percentage, Southeast Brazil has the most like Portuguese, Spanish and everything else because that's basically where the government was for, I don't know, like 200 years or something while we were like an empire and everything. So that's why we're gonna have like a lot of Portuguese people or people with Portuguese names. Sadly, a lot of those names are also in like mixed families and everything else, so it's kind of hard to keep track of who's what. For the most part, I would say, all right, the Italians would outnumber the Portuguese in today's Brazil. We had like a lot of Italians moving to the country. The Germans are a subcategory of immigrants. They have like big communities in South Brazil, but they're mostly isolated to that region. Like there's not like a German communities in other regions of Brazil, just as the southern one. The Maybe like in São Paulo there might be some, but it's not nearly as big. It's like almost neglectable. But in regards to the actual hard numbers, I can't tell you. I really can't, sorry.
And that's no problem. I like to just for my own pleasure of knowing these things, I like to think about the demographic composition of overseas white settlement countries, like Brazil, Argentina, America, and what white peoples have formed them. Maybe think about their national character from that information. Now we have a donation from Reed Johnson over on Odyssey. for 10 American dollars, and he asks, Americans are fond of using the term Brazilification to describe the ongoing process of mass demographic change that's now happening to them. As a Brazilian, what do you make of what's going on in the North? He means United States. And do you find this word Brazilification useful and comparable to your life experience?
Sadly, yes. I have also lived in the U.S. for 6 months in the past. And to be honest, just as one of your comments said, there's a lot of them in Florida and Orlando. Brazilians tend to be in like closed communities, I'd say, for the most part, because they're not very good at learning other languages. So if you see a Brazilian, no, for that's a real thing. I've met several people there who were living in the U.S. for like 20 years, and their English was like horrible. Could barely say they spoke English. So they are growing in numbers, especially when there's a crisis in the country, because the Brazilians, the vast majority who leave Brazil, they are people from like small towns or people who have basically nothing to lose. So they just move there. And it's honestly sort of becoming like Brazil also. I've been to a few places in Massachusetts. I used to live there, where it reminded me a lot of Brazil because it was sort of like noisy. We have a lot of that here. Like people don't have a lot of respect about annoying others or interfering with your routine. So from people blasting music with loud cars and everything to not respecting a lot of like not being polite, I guess that's the better term for it. That's something I saw a lot in America when I was living there.
How far would you say, although do you think that the situation is comparable? Do you think America has a similar disposition of geographic concentration, or do you think the problem minorities in America are more dispersed than in Brazil?
Well, for what I could see in America, there's a lot of like I wouldn't say like mixing, but the average American it tends to be a bit more open towards that, and the people of different backgrounds tend to sort of be able to achieve success a little bit easier. So in Brazil, what sets apart most people, like white people from black people, for example, it's not usually the money they have or everything. It's because to succeed in Brazil, it's a lot harder because the taxes and everything, you have to actually make a lot of money to be able to stop being poor and become like middle class and then rich. In America, you could like do something off the books and work something like get paid in cash to buy a house, for example, which is something I saw a lot of Brazilians doing. So you have a lot of more mobility in the US, so you end up with people living closer together, for example. White neighborhoods are gonna have like a lot of Hispanics anyways at some point in time, and black people and everything. So other than the ghettos where there's actual conflict between these groups, the segregation, I guess, in America is basically non-existent anymore.
That's interesting. I want to ask you, are there any white identitarian or at least pro-white organizations operating in Brazil to your knowledge? And what do you think are their chances of achieving the aims of white identitarian politics?
There are none, and they have zero possibilities because it's illegal in Brazil to have this sort of organizations. There was actually a neo-Nazi organization in South Brazil that was arrested a few months ago, or last month, if I'm not mistaken. They had like memorabilia, like knives and everything. And it's actually something that people have tried to create in Brazil, you know, but I don't really know where this started, but we have several laws that specifically target these sorts of organizations. So it's pretty hard to you to even like openly talk about these things. Like you can't like have a pro-white organization here go to the street and start shouting those things because you're gonna spend like 30 minutes in the streets and then go to jail. No, it's not gonna happen.
Sounds pretty bad, if I'm being honest to be. Okay, so we're moving towards the end of the show, and I would like you to give some closing remarks and any of your thoughts about the possible future of Brazil after this election and after all of these events.
Well, being very honest, it's not gonna be any good, you know. So basically, what we have been seeing here is Lula is trying to send a message to every single party and possible like future candidates. He's putting like literal communists and people who are from there's a movement we have here for agrarian reform, which basically wants to invade farmers and everything to distribute land and everything, you know. So he's trying to put that sort of people to kind of run several ministries. That is not because he thinks that's a good idea. That's because despite the need and the strategy they have to negotiate political spots, they want to basically show that his party is in charge now, and nobody's gonna be able to stop them or anything like that. So he's making the most absurd choices on purpose to show force, basically, you know. And for the most part, that's not gonna end very well. The stock market is already like going down like crazy. The several sectors and even like big companies have closed down after the elections because they have predicted that this sort of thing would happen, so they don't want to pay more taxes or risk their company. So that's the economic side. Politically, there's also several let's say people trying to push for I would say like a soft bloc sort of political system in Brazil with unified currency between several South American countries. There's this possibility. There's also the possibility of political sort of unity, I guess they are trying to achieve, which basically would make Brazil become some sort of like literal soft bloc country, you know. There's not much to see here. I think in 2 years we're gonna see a possible major crisis in Brazil, and I don't know what's gonna happen after that. Honestly, the biggest threat here is the Supreme Court. They have been enforcing a police state. Basically, journalists or anyone, comedians who try to touch the subject of elections or sometimes even like criticize Lula or call Lula out on like his past crimes and everything, these people are all going to jail or being like fired from their jobs. And technically, there would be legal protections against that sort of thing, but the Supreme Court's the one doing it, so you can't really appeal to anyone else, you know. There's even like a YouTuber. He was interviewed by Glenn Greenwald. He had all his accounts like shut down, basically because he was talking about the president. He was talking about the elections, and basically he has no access to the investigation against him, He has no access to anything. His lawyers can't access also the court documents. So it's basically a total violation of any principle in our constitution. And we can't do anything about it, you know. It's gonna get probably way worse than that in a near future.
That sounds horrifying, if I'm being completely honest. Just horrifying. A lot of Americans, they complain about their Supreme Court, that it's basically a critarchy over there. But the picture you're painting for us, V, is absolutely horrifying. And now I understand why you are only one letter of the alphabet and a
Oh yeah, I
mysterious
mean,
figure.
I run
I mean,
a VPN 24/7, and my Telegram channel, which is not about Brazil, is going to keep going that way because most people here who like start mentioning these things, they are like investigated in a matter of like days. If you start talking about it publicly in your and you are in Brazil, you get like censored, arrested, and everything. And people who live in the US, there's a YouTuber. He fled the country, I guess, 2 years ago. This one justice, Supreme Court justice, he canceled his passport. He has absolutely no access to his investigation documents. His house was like raided twice or three times before he fled, and there's just like nothing he can do, you know, like there's no resources, there's no defense, there's nothing he could do.
that is scary. We have one last minute donation from Reed Johnson for $5 American over on Odyssey, and he asks, "Are you a fan of football, and what is your explanation for historical Brazilian excellence in the sport? Is it the case that genetic hybridization, black athletic ability, plus the white IQ bump the truth of the matter? I'm not saying this is good or encouraging the practice, but what is your take?"
Well, honestly, I'm not a fan. I mean, I watch it sometimes because there's, you know, it's playing everywhere, so why not? But for the most part, I don't like any team in particular. Regards to the genetics of it, I don't think so. I think it's mostly because people from a very young age, they play a lot, especially back in the day, because you do not have much to do, you know, especially like the great players, most great players in Brazil, they were not like very rich people who were at school like 24/7 studying a lot. They were kids who were playing the streets back in the day, or would that's something very common here too. They sometimes skip school to play soccer in the streets, football, and it ends up becoming something they're pretty good at. So it's a matter of chances. We have a lot of people who play it, like millions of people who play it, and sometimes we're gonna have like one or two who are just amazing.
Personally, I don't think that it's the blacks who make the bulk of the football talent. If you look at like the three best players of this World Cup, they are Lionel Messi from Argentina, Luka Modric from Croatia, and Cristiano Ronaldo from Portugal. These three guys are white, but what's also very important, all three of them are in their late 30s, right? So
Well,
it's a thing you notice about white football players. They get better with age because they become more experienced, because their technique improves, because white people learn from playing. Whereas black players, they peak around, I would say, 25, and they play good until they hit 30, and then when they become 30, they start going downhill. Now, this is not to say that white players do not become slower to recover from fatigue when they hit 30, because when men turn 30, our bodies slow down a little bit. You start feeling it. I'm 31 now, and I'm feeling it. I don't feel 25 anymore. But because white people are capable of learning, because we can improve our technique. We do not just depend on explosive muscles, right? We have genuine athleticism. We can actually improve in sports and many other things until we hit a very hard wall of turning 40, right? You don't really see many professional footballers over 40 because that's just a fact of age. You don't, although, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, when he's going to be 40, he's going to, still going to be better than me at football. So yeah, that's my theory. I think I agree with you. I think that countries like also Argentina is a football superpower. I know, great rival of Brazil, but you see, and it's a much whiter country. But still, you could even say it's better at football than Brazil.
Yeah, I guess it's a dying sport, honestly. Like, I don't watch it because I don't like the way players simply flop everywhere all the time. You know, I absolutely despise the Brazilian team because of that. They flop all the time. I don't really like cheating, and that for me is cheating a lot because, well, you're not injured. There's no like reason to just flop to the ground and feign like a, oh, I'm hurt. You know, I really don't like that. So for the most part, I think if you look at Brazil, for example, why do we have so many great players? Well, compare Brazil to Germany or France or, I don't know, England. We have so many millions more people living here. So it's easier to find more people who are good at the sport. You know, like statistically, we are going to have more good players because, we have like way more people to choose from, you know, so that's probably something like of a big, big factor. Argentina is not very big, but if you look at how much Brazilians like have historically like focused on this sport specifically, it's like a big attractive to a young poor guy to become a good professional player, get rich and everything. So it's something a lot of people focus on, not only because they like the sport, but because of the possibilities they could get from, I don't know, simply being good, maybe not on an international level, but on a local level, that's also pretty good.
Yeah, it's it used to be like this in Germany and England and France and Italy as well, you know, poor guys, white working class lads, they would play football and become successful. I remember there is this interview with the English footballer, I think his name is Crouch, and he's very ugly. He's a very ugly man, and he knows it. Someone asked him, if you weren't a football player, what would you be? And he said, a virgin. Like, this guy's, I mean, he has character. His face has character, but it is just a fact of life that sometimes it's not about the money. Sometimes it's really about the women. And this brings the show to a conclusion. There are no new donations over on any of the platforms. So I want to thank you for being with us, V, despite your difficulties, despite the risk that the speaking out about the situation in Brazil carries. I thank you for that deeply. And with that, this has been the Writer's Block, people. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey, and I want to thank V, and I want to thank Leonardo Heredia from Argentina for being our guests tonight, and for letting us know what's going on with the white people of South America, specifically Argentina and Brazil. I want to thank everyone who tuned in live to listen and, you know, put up with our technical difficulties. And I want to thank everyone listening to the replay. We do this for you so that you may become better white nationalists, so that we may refine our methodologies and have more success in the cause in the future. I want to thank everyone who commented in the DLive and Odyssey chats. I depend on the chat to keep this show running. I get a lot of ideas for questions to the guests from the chat, and I riff off of the chat. I have fun reading it. I also want to thank everyone who donated. Your donations is what keeps this operation going, what makes the broader Countercurrents operation possible. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Gaius Maximus, Reed Johnson, and Bartleby, for keeping the chat safe and for keeping everyone abreast of all of the relevant links. And with that, yeah, I guess this has been the writer's block. Bye-bye, people. Take care.